Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 88, Peak Performance Sports Psychology, May 6, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Absolutely. This information applies at any level, whether you're a student performing at that level, or whether you're a musician, or a surgeon, or an athlete. It's the ability to recognize when you're off task, recognize when you're distracted, and be able to refocus on really what's important in related to that performance. That's across the board, you know, whether you're doing, you know, whether you're making a formula for a new drug, or whether you're studying for a test, or whether you're getting ready to play a basketball game. Those concepts are universal and across the board in terms of focusing.
That was the voice of my guest, Patrick Cohn, Ph.D. Sports psychology expert Dr. Patrick Cohn has been an athlete and a coach. According to his website, he's experienced firsthand how beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors influence performance. His passion for sports was born early in life and grew as he participated in sports such as football, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, racquetball, and golf. After competing in sports for many years, Dr. Cohn went on to study and research how mental attitudes shape physical performance, and he earned a Ph.D. in applied sports psychology. The more he studied champion athletes and their mindsets, the more he realized that winning attitudes are the key to performing well in competition. Dr. Cohn has dedicated his mental game coaching practice to helping coaches, athletic trainers, and parents of aspiring athletes. He's the president and founder of Peak Performance Sports in Orlando, Florida. He is considered a leading authority on mental skills for entering the zone and pre-performance routines, largely based on his extensive research. He is a mentor to many in the field of sports psychology and provides performance enhancement skills through mental game coaching for individual and team athletes. In fact, he has consulted with high-profile teams such as the Miami Dolphins, NASCAR winners, national motocross champions, and PGA Tour professional golfers such as Brian Watts and J.L. Lewis. He's also worked with powerful corporations such as IBM and USA Today. In addition to his work with athletes, Dr. Cohn has been a sports commentator on the Golf Channel. For more information, you can visit his website at www.peaksports.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Patrick Cohn, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm really glad that you could make it. I want to start off talking about the field of sports psychology generally, because you're a sports psychologist, and I think people would like to know more about the field. So, first of all, what is a sports psychologist?
Well, a sports psychologist, or what I call a mental game coach, is someone that works on the mental preparation components for an athlete, such as helping them to focus better, concentrate better, helping them to improve their confidence, deal with setbacks and distractions, and stay composed in sport. But you can look at it from different perspectives. I mean, there's researchers out there that are actively looking at, on the research side, they're looking at how psychological behaviors and thoughts influence performance. And then there's applied people like myself that are actually working with athletes and helping athletes reach their peak potential in sports.
Right. Yeah, I figured there probably would be a division of applied versus academic. I know that's true in my own field of clinical psychology. Give us a sense of what some of the on the research side. I know you're on the applied side, and we're going to be investigating that quite a bit. What's been going on in the research side or the more academic side of the field?
Well, on the more academic or the research side, what they want to do, just like in your field, is they want where they can validate, look at studies where they can actually validate some of the concepts that are going on. They look at state and trait anxiety, for example, and how that may affect athletic performance. Or they'll look at self-efficacy, for example, and they'll study self-efficacy, find out, you know, does that have is there differences in athletes, and does that have an effect on performance? They'll look at various visualization techniques and how that may have an impact on performance as well. And there's a lot of other areas on the fringe in terms of looking at participation, you know, and why kids stay involved in sports and things like that as well.
You know, that you just sparked something. It may be a little bit tangential, but I saw an article in the paper yesterday about PE in school, you know, physical exercise, and in a lot of ways that's kind of declined. And I was reading that there's a video game system that people have been adapting. I think it's called Dance, Dance, Dance or something like that. They've got this program, and the kids are just loving dancing, partly, I think, because of the non-competitive nature of it.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with competition. I think if it's done in the right way, competition can actually spur kids on and can spur athletes on. And what I mean by competition is, and I think generally athletes use that as a motivator, from my perspective, is they love really to compete against others. They love the intensity. They love the adrenaline, that competition. Now, earlier on, there's some kids that maybe aren't as self-confident in their abilities, and they shy away from that competitive experience.
Yes.
So, but it's to succeed in sports, you do need a competitive spirit. You need to embrace and enjoy competition.
Right, right. And many people do, and certainly some people don't, probably for the kinds of reasons that you just discussed. Getting back to the field generally, I'm wondering if there are any different schools of thought or any sort of major conflicts that cleave the field. You know, often in a field there will be opposing sides or different points of view. What are the polarities within sports psychology, if any?
Well, you know, I've been out of academia. I used to teach at the... I've been out of academia so long that I don't really stay up with all the research and from the academic side. But I guess an ongoing that we started to talk about is researchers in sports psychology feel like that you first need to research and validate what you're doing before you go and you take it out to working with athletes on the applied level. Now, the people like myself that are doing applied work feel like it's all about gaining experience and finding out what works, using an eclectic approach and finding out what works with athletes. And that's kind of the theory that I ascribe to, is use what works with athletes. And based upon my experience over the last, 15, 16 years working with athletes, I've found a system based upon my experience of helping athletes that I know works.
Well, I want to get into that system in just a moment. You mentioned you've been doing it for 15 or 16 years. How old would you say the field of sports psychology is? How long has it been around?
Well, it depends how you define that, because you could go back and you could say Newt Rockne, for example, in football was a sports psychologist in his own right. Great coaches from the past were sports psychologists in their own right. Why? Because they knew how to motivate athletes. Because they knew how to get athletes into a confident state of mind. They knew what to say to them before competition to get them ready. So, I mean, you can go back many, many years ago, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. I think modern sports psychology has been around for about 30 years, I would say.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, you know, particularly of PhD psychologists such as yourself. I know the American Psychological Association has 50-plus different divisions. I don't know if there's a division of sports psychology. Is there, or is there some other professional organization?
There is out there, and I'm not, let's just clear it up, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a licensed psychologist, and that's why I don't advertise I'm a sports psychologist. I call myself a mental game coach or a master mental game coach because I teach other people my system, but there's the Association for the Advancement of Applied Sports Psychology, that's called ASP. And then there's Division 47, I believe, of the APA, which is the sports psychology, the American Psychological Association, arm, you could say. So, from both perspectives, in terms of what group is leading the field, I don't know. I think both of them are kind of doing their own thing and not necessarily communicating too much with each other. But so those are the two main bodies that you have that are governing this whole area of sports psychology. You can become a certified consultant for ASP or Applied Sports Association for Applied Sports Psychology. Now I'm not as familiar with Division 47 of the APA, because I am not a member of the APA.
Okay, I made a mistake. I just assumed, because I saw on your website, Dr. Patrick Cohen, I assumed that you had a PhD in psychology.
Very good question. No, I came through the different route, which is through physical education and exercise science.
Ah.
There is two different routes that you can take in sports psychology, and one is through sports and movement and physical education, exercise science, physical therapy. That's the route I came up through. And then there's the whole clinical route where you can go and you can become a trained, you know, a licensed psychologist, but you can have you can have a track as your education. You can have a track in sports psychology.
Okay. Okay.
That's a completely different avenue, and
that's
someone that would be more in the APA, Division 47 of the APA.
Well, that's good to know, because some people that listen to the show are still in the formative stages of their education and career, so if there are people who are interested in following in your footsteps, they'll know that there are at least two different paths that they could follow, one going through psychology and the other going through a physical education, coming more out of a strong sports background. So I noticed on your website that you've worked with sports teams. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yes. And that's primarily what I do. I mean, primarily what I do is I offer a service to athletes and teams. And what I'll typically do is I'll have them, let's say I'm working with an individual athlete, for example, I'll have them complete my assessment, which is called my AMAP, my athlete's mental aptitude profile. This isn't a validated or a standardized test. This is a simple 5-page test that I developed based upon my experience of some of the mental game challenges that prior students have had.
So what kinds of issues would you be assessing there? What, give us a sense of what some of the questions might be.
And notice I call them students and not clients, because it's very educational in nature. This is not psychopathology at all. It's very educational. It's mental skills training and oriented. What I test for is I look at, number one, I look at kind of their goals and how specific their goals are. Do they have a direction where they're going? I ask broad questions about their understanding of the mental game. What type of challenges do they feel like they have? Some athletes will come here, they know exactly what challenges they have. Others, they don't, and I need to help them uncover some of the challenges or blocks that they have in their performance. Sometimes I'll get an athlete that just wants to get better, and that's the ideal situation, is an athlete will come in and just want to improve and isn't slumping. Unfortunately, in my field, we're the last resort. We're the last frontier for a slumping athlete or an athlete that's having trouble with their performance. And so they'll find a mental coach to help them climb out of that slump. And that's really unfortunate because my field about performance enhancement and improving mental skills is just another aspect of coaching and improvement and education, and that's how I look at it. I also look at their confidence. I look at what type of doubts they have about their sport. I look at their composure and their ability to let go of mistakes, their expectations, and if they have any limiting expectations or beliefs that are holding them back. I'll ask a little bit about their practice, a little bit about their routines for their pregame warm-up. So it's very comprehensive in terms of, you know, what I'm looking at. I'll even look at things like social approval, for example, and just how much concern they have for other people in their life and how that may affect their sport performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that all makes a lot of sense. Now, what about when you're working with a team? I would imagine that there'd be unique challenges in working with a group of people as opposed to an individual person.
Absolutely. And I do the same process. I start with a simple one-page evaluation. I get a sense for what's going on with the team. I'll talk with the coaches or the coach, get a sense from the coach, and then I'll develop a unique program for that specific team. And because you're working with a team, now you've got group dynamics.
Yes.
And as soon as you throw in group dynamics, you have to look into a lot of other areas, such as communication is really huge in group dynamics, looking at communication between athletes, coach-athlete communication, athlete-coach communication, teamwork. The big buzzword in this area is team cohesion and how apt that the members of the group are able to stick together when challenged. So that's huge. Leadership, both from a coaching perspective and from an internal leadership, is also very important when talking about team dynamics. So yes, primarily, you're working both in performance enhancement, mental skills such as confidence and focusing and composure, and then you're also working in the teamwork aspects. Most of the time, coaches will bring me in to work on the performance enhancement of the individual athletes, mm-hmm. and not so much the teamwork. There are people out there that are specializing in this area, just working in the area of teamwork and leadership and communication. I guess if you were to say what my specialty is, it would be more on the performance enhancement side, working on confidence and focus, composure, trust, mental preparation techniques.
Okay, and what are some of the sports teams that you've worked with or the sports? Are we talking football or tennis teams or baseball teams or what?
I have worked with baseball teams here at the college level and also at the grade school level and high school level. I've worked with the Miami Dolphins, one of the professional teams. I came in and worked with their coaching staff a couple of years ago. I've done a lot of work with golf teams because I published several golf books, and that was my original claim to fame, if I can say, is I published 4 golf books, and I've worked with a lot of tour professional golfers on an individual level. So that, transferred into working with teams as well. Mostly at the collegiate level, I find that those are the coaches that are most likely to bring in a mental coach or a sports psychologist to work with their team. So, various teams, mostly in golf, baseball, and a little bit of football.
Okay. Can I assume that golf is your sport then?
It is. I mean, it's a specialty area of mine. Golf is a specialty area of mine. But today I work with athletes and teams of all levels. Specifically, I work with racing teams quite a bit. Another specialty of mine is also working with motocross and auto racers. So that's another kind of a specialty. But I work with tennis players, basketball players, you name it. I have skaters that I work with, you know, individual athletes on that side. So it seems like a lot of the individual athletes will gravitate towards working with me. But I also work with individual athletes from teams as well, like in tennis and baseball and hockey and the whole gamut.
Well,
I started in the area of golf.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like it's not boring. It sounds like it's very varied.
It's never ending. I mean, it's you can always, you know, find new avenues and new things to do. We're constantly working on producing the best mental game products we can that are very applied in nature and that are very simple for even young athletes to understand. I recently co-authored a book called The Ultimate Sports Parent with my sister, who is Lisa Cohn. She's a writer herself. So we're trying to disseminate the information even down to parents now, and helping parents, you know, transfer some of the mental skills to young athletes. And we're finding that that's a really just an area that's exploding right now, the whole sports parenting thing. And there's not a lot of material out there. There's been a couple of books written that you can find. But we did a real practical and applied CD program and workbook program. So there's always opportunities to do real applied and specific products, and we're expanding on that. You know, every day we're expanding. We're looking for challenges that coaches have, that athletes have, that sports parents have, that will help them, you know, in their careers.
Yes, I notice you have a lot of products on your website. It's very entrepreneurial website. You've got a lot going on there. One of the things you talk about there is developing mental toughness, and I guess maybe that's one of the skills that you're referring to. What do you mean by mental toughness, and how do you help people develop that?
Well, mental toughness is a very broad term that we use, and it relates once again to performance enhancement. For example, mental toughness relates to an athlete's level of confidence. If you go up to bat, or if you go to hit a shot, or if you go to hit a tennis serve, if you don't have complete confidence and conviction in your ability and your skills, most likely that's going to show up in your performance. So one of the areas we look at is helping athletes improve their confidence and keep their confidence when they're challenged by mistakes or adversity or failure, for example. So that would be one component of mental toughness that we're looking at and helping athletes improve. But you can look at the whole gamut, staying focused under adversity, staying focused under pressure, staying composed under pressure, and not getting affected by fear of failure or, you know, other mental game challenges that we see. So mental toughness is just an athlete's ability to be confident and focused and composed in competition and not let their mental game get in their own way, as we say.
Yes. Now, maybe that ties into, I know, you've done some work for some major corporations such as IBM.
Yeah, that was IBM Canada had brought me in to do some seminars. And we can definitively say that the mental skills that we're working on with athletes apply to any career, any performance. As long as you're talking about performance, I don't care if it's surgery, and I know colleagues of mine that have worked with surgeons, or if it's musicians, and colleagues of mine have worked with musicians, or students. My material is being used to work with students as well. When you talk about focusing, when you talk about confidence, and then you talk about composure and mental preparation and all those skills, I mean, don't they apply across the board to any career?
Yes, yeah.
Certainly. I teach my system to coaches. I have a program, I don't know if you ran across it, it's called the MGCP program, That's my mental game coaching professional certification that I do. It's an intensive 10 or 20-week course that I do with coaches. I've had psychologists that have been in it. I've had therapists in it. And one of these, a grade school coach that works in the area of lacrosse and is also a teacher at the grade school level, he took the material in the MGCP program, and he does a course for students called Mental Coaching for Students or Mental Training for Students. So absolutely, this information applies at any level, whether you're a student performing at that level or whether you're a musician or a surgeon or an athlete or any other career. I've done seminars for Bayer Labs, for example. They brought me in, just wanted me to talk about how I can improve concentration and focus and remove some of the distractions that they have, you know, in their work.
So what would you tell them in a situation like that?
Well, once again, I did an assessment. We did a full-blown survey and assessment, and we found out what were the challenges that they were having, when were these distractions and the challenges, what things did they bring in from their life to work that were challenges. So we did a full-blown assessment and tried to get as much information as we can related to concentration, focusing, and refocusing. And then I would go in and do the seminar with them, talking about how to have a routine to improve your focus, how to identify what's important to focus on. We call those task-relevant performance cues. How to identify what the distractions are. I presented the results of the survey. And then give them a specific technique for being able to refocus when they're distracted. And that's what it really comes down to. Everybody gets distracted. It's the ability to recognize when you're off task, recognize when you're distracted, and be able to refocus on really what's important in related to that performance. That's across the board, you know, whether you're doing, you know, whether you're making a formula for a new drug or whether you're studying for a test or whether you're getting ready to play a basketball game. Those concepts are universal and across the board in terms of focusing. I try to make it really simple and really basic and don't throw a lot of psychological jargon at athletes because sometimes they don't understand that, or you may turn off some people when you start throwing around a lot of jargon that they can't really relate to. So I try to make it really simple for them to understand at a basic level and to be able to apply it easily as well.
Yes, yes. Your mentioning of focus reminds me of one of your newsletters. I'm now on your newsletter list, and I saw one recently about being in the zone, which reminded me of psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's work. He's written books on flow, which is, I think, partly where that, at least some of the academic concept around the idea of being, quotes, in the zone comes from. How do you promote flow or being in the zone? Maybe you could say a little bit about what that is for our listeners, too.
Absolutely. Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote the book Flow, The Psychology of Optimal, I think it's Experience, great material. I use it all the time in my work. He actually speaks at the ASP conference that they have. They typically bring him in to talk. And I've heard him speak live. I've read his books, and the material is right on in terms of helping athletes as well. And he talks, flow is basically a concept of becoming totally immersed into what you're doing in the moment and how people in their life find enjoyment from that process of being fully immersed and fully engrossed into the moment and what they're doing. And to perform your best, it's kind of a Zen approach. To perform your best, you have to be fully immersed into what you're doing. If you're distracted or your mind is elsewhere, you're not going to be. And he talks about some of the prerequisites for getting into this state of flow, which I call a mini zone. And anybody can be in this state of flow, as he talks about. But so if you have clear goals and you're getting clear feedback about how you're doing, and you're fully immersed into the present moment, and you lose the sense of being self-conscious, he says it's more likely that you're going to enter the state of being into the state of flow. So flow is very much about a concentrated state of being.
Yes, yes. And you mentioned Zen, which reminded me of another important book, which I wouldn't be surprised if it influenced you at some point. It was in the, I think, the early 70s that Tim Galway wrote Inner Tennis.
The Inner Game of Tennis,
yes,
and he wrote The Inner Game of Golf as well.
Okay.
I recommend it to many of my students that come in, my athletes that come in and work with me. The Inner Game of Tennis is a classic, and that really started this whole, I don't want to say revolution, but that really kick-started sports psychology. He was kind of one of the original fathers, I guess you could say, of sports psychology, and coming out with a mass market paperback. And The Inner Game of Tennis, written by Tim Galloway, it's all about tapping into your creative part of your mind rather than your analytical part of your mind. So he talks about self one versus self two, and how in order to perform better, you have to suspend self one, your analytical mindset, while self two, your more your creative, natural, instinctive part of you, can perform. And so it was kind of really revolutionary at that time in the mid 70s. Him coming out with that information, he found it out by just working with beginning tennis players. He had found out if he gave beginning tennis players a simple, you could say a mantra. It's not a mantra, but a simple saying that would suspend their trying mind or their analytical mind, he found out they were able to perform better in that situation when they just let their body react and do what, he was training them to do. So it was all experiential on his part as being a tennis coach. It was very kind of intuitive, and maybe he had read up on some of the left brain, right brain material or research that was out there to, kind of spark him with the idea. And today we call it the training mindset or the practice mindset, which is his self one, and self two is what we call the performance mindset or the trusting mindset. So there's a translation today that I use as well from that material. So I recommend anybody that's interested in performance enhancement or studying how that concept works to go and pick up the Inner Game of Tennis.
That's great. I didn't realize quite how formative and important his work was in the field. I know it did influence me, tennis being one of the sports that I was involved in earlier years, never at a really competitive level, but still at my own level, I was able to try out some of his ideas and certainly experience those wonderfully delicious, all too rare moments of flow where everything just clicked and was effortless. And, that's a wonderful experience when it happens.
Right.
Since I'm name dropping here, I guess. I wonder if you're familiar with Michael Murphy. He wrote a book called Golf in the Kingdom. As a golfer, if you don't know that book, I would really recommend it.
Yes, Golf in the Kingdom. I'm not really familiar. I've heard of the book, and I probably read it many years ago. But that's a classic as well. There's so many golf books out there that are on the kind of the mental, or you could say, spiritual side. That book, I think, is more like a mental game, spiritual type.
Yes,
book.
It is.
There's so many mental game books out there today on the mental game of golf. It's incredible. It's getting to a place where it's overcrowded. It's hard to determine what are the really good publications out there and what aren't good.
Yeah. I really recommend Michael Murphy to you. He's got a newer book called The Future of the Body. And I think he also wrote one earlier called In the Zone. But the future of the body is like this compendium, I think, of mind, body, material, covers a lot of research and also sort of looks into the future, as I recall. It's been a while since I looked at it, but he's an interesting guy. He's the guy who founded the Esalen Institute out here on the West Coast, which led to a whole explosion of interest in what broadly would be characterized as human potential. And he was very interested in sport himself and became a long distance runner.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress. What about the role of visualization in what you do? Does that play much of a role?
It does. I would like to mention that most people have a misunderstanding of really what sports psychology and mental coaching is all about. They often think of it as goal setting and visualization, and that's primarily what we do. And that's really, really far from the truth in terms of what I do. But there is a place for it. It's probably only about 5%, maybe 5% of what I do with athletes. Mm-hmm. But visualization really was popularized by Jack Nicklaus, you know, and how he, in his books, described how he would go to the movies in his head. But there's been a lot of research out there done on visualization from the academia side. What's important from my perspective in terms of visualization, that athletes perform not just with visual images, and visualization kind of implies a visual type of image. There's many, many images that athletes use to perform, from kinesthetic or feel-oriented images to auditory images, tactile images, for example. And I like to use the term imagery or mental imagery rather than visualization, because it doesn't – visualization to me seems – like it's more, has just more of a visual component to it.
Too narrow.
An athlete, too narrow.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get the person to really imagine themselves fully into the situation with all of their senses?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. When I was at Cal State Fullerton, working with a guy named Ken Revizza, who's another kind of one of what I consider one of the fathers of modern sports psychology. We used to do some studies with the gymnasts, which they had a very high, you know, very high level collegiate gymnastics program there. And Dr. Revizza would work with the gymnasts quite often, and I would go around with them to help out. And we did a study looking at real-time visualization and found out that the best gymnasts were able to visualize their beam routine, for example, to approximate closer real-time of what would actually happen during a beam routine. So that was a little interesting finding that we did in a study when I was in my master's program at Cal State Fullerton. This was back in the mid-80s. I was at Cal State Fullerton studying with Ken Revizza. But there's been a lot of research done in that area of mental imagery and visualization. It seems like that's the rep that sports psychology, that the layperson knows that it's all about visualization and goal setting, and it's really not.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I think that's probably was a lot of the impression that I have as well. It's kind of interesting what you're saying about real-time visualization or imagining. I was studying Tai Chi, and I would try to, maybe when I was laying in bed or something, to visualize or re-experience going through the Tai Chi moves. And I found that you really have to have very good concentration to do that and not have your mind wander off into something else. I found that to be very challenging.
Yes, yes.
Talk about focus. It takes a lot of focus. Do you find that that's a skill that people improve on with practice?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think the most, at the basic level, it's the ability to understand what's important to focus on and then being able to immerse yourself in those cues and then fend yourself off from distractions. More or less what I called earlier is being able to refocus when you do have distractions. Concentration is very, very important in anything that people do, especially at the athletic level. You think about a racer who's going around the track at 200 miles an hour, you don't think concentration is important, and if they get one distraction, it could mean their life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, good point. Now, I know you also have a podcast. Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
We have a podcast that we've been operating for about a year. It's called Get Psyched for Sports. It's our sports psychology podcast, where we'll pick a current event or we'll pick a quote from an athlete, and we'll give a quick tip, basically, on the mental game. It's called Get Psyched for Sports, a sports psychology podcast. Just to educate, athletes and parents and coaches out there, once again, about some of the techniques and some of the mental strategies that we're using in sports psychology.
Okay, well, as we begin to wind down here, I wonder if you have any advice for people who might be interested in becoming a sports psychologist or any universities that you would recommend that have that sort of an orientation?
If anybody's interested, the first thing that they need to do is go to the Association for the Advancement of Applied Sports Psychology and get the Graduate Directory of Sports Psychology Programs.
Oh.
Now, I did my PhD at the University of Virginia with Bob Rotella, who's well-known in the area of golf psychology. He's no longer there. That program went more towards, I think, exercise psychology rather than sports psychology. So I don't know if I can recommend Virginia anymore, but there's a lot of great schools out there. University of Arizona. I know Ron Smith, who I know used to be at the university there at Seattle, University of Washington. There's a lot of great universities out there that are doing applied work, and you have to decide which direction that you want to go in. The graduate directory will help you, give you an understanding of what they're doing at the various universities and what their research interests are. That's the first place you need to start if you want to go that direction. And then decide whether you're going to go through physical education or you're going to go through more of the clinical route as well. That's the very first place that people need to start.
Okay, so again, as we wrap it up here, I wonder if there's anything you didn't get a chance to say or any last words you'd like to leave our audience with.
Well, like I said, I have an MGCP program. If there's people out there that really don't want to go back to school and study sports psychology, I have a program that I teach called my MGCP certification for qualified individuals, qualified coaches, therapists, and psychologists that want, you can say, a kind of a prepackaged system and kind of learning my system and having my assessment tools and the strategies that I use with athletes. That program's been pretty successful. We're also going to do a boot camp, what's called a mental training boot camp in Orlando this summer. If anybody's interested in the mental training boot camp, they can go to peaksports.com and search for mental training boot camp. It's a two-day weekend that we're doing with athletes and coaches and sports parents. That will be a good way to kind of get your feet wet in this whole area of sports psychology.
Okay. Well, I will put a link to www.peaksports.com in our show notes. And Dr. Patrick Cohn, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Patrick Cohn. My own days of athletic prowess are fading into the past, And it's this thought that brings back a story from younger days that I thought would be fun to share with you. It's been some time since I've shared one of these stories. In fact, it was way back in show number 46 that I told the story about winning the Liars Contest at the county fair in Lolo, Montana. Well, on that same day, I also won the Greased Pig Contest. So once again, travel back with me to yesteryear. I'm a mild-mannered graduate student enrolled in an MA psychology program at the University of Montana. And somewhere I see a flyer about the upcoming fair to be held in Lolo, Montana, which at the time is barely more than a wide spot in the road, some distance south of Missoula. The thing that really catches my eye is that there's going to be a greased pig contest. I get really fired up about this, probably because there was a story about a greased pig contest in an early Dick and Jane reader when I was first learning to read, and also I'd seen the Paul Newman movie, Cool Hand Luke, which had a wonderful greased pig contest in it. Now, I'm normally a somewhat shy and retiring type, but somehow I'm seized with a confidence about this greased pig thing that has me going around for weeks before the event, announcing to all my fellow grad students that I'm going to enter and win the Greased Pig Contest in Lolo. The day of the contest arrives, and I've signed up for the Greased Pig event, but it turns out to be much different than the version I had seen in Cool Hand Luke. As I recall in the movie, they turned a bunch of greased pigs loose, and all these people are running down the street of this old West-type town, and Paul Newman and the others are out there chasing them. But here in Lolo, the setup is different. I am standing around in a corral with a bunch of hard-looking Montana cowboy, cowgirl types, and there's going to be just one greased pig put in the corral with us. And whoever can catch the pig, lift him up, and throw him into the back of a pickup truck will be the winner. So they've got us all herded together, me and the cowboys at one end of the corral. Then at the other end of the corral, they let loose the greased pig. The crowd of contestants surges forward toward the pig. But I get a bad start, and everybody else is ahead of me. But the pig runs right through everybody's legs, and he's coming my way. I dive on him and get him in a hammerlock with a bear hug around him and a firm grip on one of his legs. The rest of the crowd dogpiles on top of me. I'm being crushed. I can barely breathe. But the pig, he's grunting and squealing plenty. Finally, the referees start peeling people off the pile. I can see daylight. As soon as they have the people peeled off and it's clear that I've got the pig, I manage to struggle to my feet, and I've got to carry the sucker who's not full grown and probably only about 75 pounds or so, but he does feel heavy and slippery, and I'm carrying him across the corral to throw him into the back of the waiting pickup truck. I get to the truck, and I'm ready to throw him into the truck, but I'm feeling this resistance. I look back, and I see that a woman has his two hind legs. She's grabbed his hind legs with her hands, and she's saying, "Let go of him, he's mine!" But I'm not about to let go of my prize, and I give a mighty yank, and I jerk the pig out of her hands and toss him into the truck. And just as I'm turning around from this victorious moment, I see that she has a roundhouse punch aimed right at my head. I manage to duck her punch, and thankfully some other folks grab her and drag her off. She's had a bit too much to drink. Well, I have to tell you, it felt pretty great to actually have won the Greased Pig contest after all the bragging I'd done about how I was going to win. Now, you might be wondering what the prize was. The prize was I could keep the pig or take $10. Well, I took the $10 because I already had a monkey at home that was making my life pure hell. But that's another story for another time.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, hear Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
This is show number 88, and so show number 100 can't be far away and probably deserves a celebration of some sort. So I've asked for you to send in audio clips that I can play on that show. We have an early entry, and I thought I'd share it with you now just to get you inspired. Here it is.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Anna from Israel, and you are presenting the 100th issue of Shrink Wrap Radio, the show that speaks from the psychologist in you to the psychologist in us. All the psychology we need to know and just enough to make us dangerous. Ooh.
Thank you so much for that, Anna. I hope I get some more clips like that for my 100th birthday. Also, you know the little transition, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave or any other clever thing along those lines that you can think of that I can use as a bumper or a transition or a promo, whatever. I've said I'll send someone a copy of the book, Warriors, Settlers, and Nomads by Terrence Watts, a recent guest, for the best audio transition received before the end of this month of May 2007. So for either the 100th show celebration or a transition, please just send me a short voice clip. If you have the setup, you can send an MP3 file to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can click on the My Chingo logo on our website and record it there, or you can leave a voice message on Skype, and our message line is 206-888-2746. As I've said, the decision of the judges is final, the judge being me, and I'll announce the winner in early June, so be sure to listen. If you hear that you're the winner, then email me with your mailing address so I can get a copy of the book to you. And to give you a little bit more inspiration to create those transitions, here's one of the latest ones that I just received.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Thank you very much for that, Fernando Blanco, who in the past has helped me take some of the uhs and ums out of the interviews. I haven't had to call on him recently because my guests have been doing a pretty good job of policing themselves. But Fernando, I'm sure I'll be getting back to you with more editing at some point. Now we have four new additions to our Frapper map. I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Kevin in Limerick, Ireland, who says, I'm a psychology student studying in Nuig, that's N-U-I-G, in Ireland. Big fan of Shrink Wrap Radio. Well done. Well, Kevin, I'm always happy to hear from people in Ireland, one of my favorite places. But I have to tell you, N-U-I-G threw me, and I had to go to the internet to look it up, and it's National University of Ireland, Galway. And I've been in Galway and very much enjoyed my visit there. Next person on the Frapper map was Vivan. I'm wondering if there was a typo and it could have been Vivian, but what was written looks like it was Vivan in Auckland, New Zealand, who says, great show. And then we hear from Nilakshi in Colombo, Sri Lanka, who writes, two thumbs up, Dr. Dave. Great source of information for psych students. Well, thank you so much. And What a thrill it was for me to hear from Sri Lanka, an island off the southern tip of India. And then we have Trevor, finally, in Kennewick, Washington, who writes, "Keep up the awesome work. Always love listening to the show." Well, I hate to admit how compulsive I am about the Frapper map, but most every night before I go to bed, I take a look to see if there are any new additions. So I'm always thrilled when I find that there are. So if you aren't on our map yet, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to the Shrink Wrap Radio Frapper map. I want to let you know also that there's a new episode of my other podcast series at Wise Counsel, it's actually http://wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. The latest interview there is with psychologist Dr. Jeffrey Bernstein, and it's on dealing with defiant children. He was very dynamic. It's a good one, especially if you have kids. As a matter of fact, one of my faithful Shrink Wrap Radio listeners heard the show and posted the following audio clip in response.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Anna from Israel, and I am abusing your chingo of the Shrink Wrap Radio because I couldn't enter a comment on mentalhelp.net, and I wanted to react to your interview with Dr. Bernstein. I found it a very, very valuable interview, and especially since I'm a father myself and I can see my sons being defiant from time to time. But I was wondering about, let's say, the flip side of this. You know, if a child is not feeling happy and doesn't feel that he's being understood, it doesn't necessarily have to show this by being defiant. As a matter of fact, I think as a parent, at least I as a parent, am very happy when my child is defiant. You know, I really applaud that. I respect that. I think he's courageous. And maybe that's because I remember when I as a child felt bad, I got depressed and I was never defiant. And so somehow this led my parents to believe that everything was okay because I was, you know, silently go along my own way. So how does Dr. Bernstein, or you for that matter, look on an issue such as that, you know, when a child sort of seemingly functions well but is a little bit silent and has the odd indication that he's not feeling too well, like, you know, bed watering or not sleeping too well or sometimes crying or not having too many friends? What do you do then? Well, give us an answer in any case.
Hey, An, thank you so much for that response. And wow, you get featured twice on the same show. See how good it is to send in audio clips? They get a lot of weight, a lot of attention from me. I think you make some very good points there. And of course, you're right that the conflict that a child might be experiencing can be expressed in a variety of ways. I would say I was much like you were as a child. I'd be more inclined to be depressed than to act things out defiantly. I was not a defiant child either. And to make kind of a broad generalization, I think there are two kinds of people, if you will, those who act out, who somehow express it in an outer way against the world, usually in an angry way, and those of us who turn it inward, and that's more likely to manifest itself in terms of subtler kinds of symptoms such as depression or psychosomatic disorders of one sort or another. So there's a bit of a response to the very important point that you raised. Before I leave this segment of the show, I need to ask you for a favor. There's a contest going on here in the U.S. for the next host for NPR. If you're outside of the U.S., NPR stands for National Public Radio, and it is really the intellectually prestigious network, and I'd love to have some affiliation with them. So I've entered their contest by submitting one of my Shrink Wrap Radio promos, and you can vote for me by going to the following website, publicradioquest.com/node, that's N-O-D-E, /205. Now, you may have to register on the site to vote, but that doesn't take too long. Thanks. And I should mention once again our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. And one of the places you will find this show is at shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com. You can subscribe to it there, and you'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Brother Bernard Seif in Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania. I'm calling just to let everyone know that even monks listen to Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks for the great podcasts.
Thank you, Brother Bernard, and it's always good to hear from you. And now you are officially entered in the May Transition Contest. Okay, let's get on to some recent emails. First, we hear from B in Cincinnati, Ohio, who writes, I'm writing to report that I've enjoyed the podcasts available on Shrink Wrap Radio, but I'm always dismayed at the very beginning due to the introduction. Why do you want a sexually suggestive sounding intro that would better suit a softcore or, quotes, men's site? Definitely not a plus. Well, B raises an interesting point in reference to the female voice at the opening saying, all the psychology you need to know and just enough to make you a little bit dangerous. I think I knew there might be a possibility that there'd be some adverse reactions to that sexy intro, but I thought it might help to liven things up a bit and give the show a bit of energy. Now, B is the only complaint about this that I've received so far, so I'd be interested to know how do others of you feel about that. Let me know. Maybe I'll retire it, or just use it occasionally, or maybe I'll keep it. So let me hear your thoughts on that. But at any rate, B, I appreciate your feedback, even when it's critical, because it's feedback like that that helps me sharpen up the show and make it more broadly appealing. So I'm definitely giving it serious consideration, what you said. Next, Derek P. in Vancouver writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. Just filled out your show survey, finally, and you'll find I submitted it twice because I remembered an important point I'd forgotten to include in the first submission. And then he goes on to say, The most recent show I heard, interviewing Dr. Zimbardo, was one of your best ever. And right after I heard it, I noticed that the most recent episode of the University Channel podcast is also an hour-long talk given by Dr. Zimbardo on April 18th, 2007, at the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures, and Commerce, whatever that is. And he goes on to say that he recommends the University Channel podcast in general. They put out podcasts about every day. And there's a long URL. He gave me a couple of URLs. They're pretty long. So let me just say that if you go to http://uc.princeton.edu and kind of search for their University Channel podcast series, I'm sure you'll find it. He says it's put out by Princeton University and features talks by an array of top-level experts from academia, government, and business on a range of topics. They pump out the talks at a high rate, at least one a day on average, covering so many subjects from so many perspectives that it's a pick-and-choose sort of thing. But the titles of the talks and the affiliation of the speakers are detailed enough to allow educated guesses as to which meets one's personal interests, and the first few minutes suffice to confirm one's intuition. For me, at least, the hits far outnumber the misses, and when they're good, as they often are, they are very, very good, and in many cases offer fresh perspectives in areas outside one's usual range of interests, which can be surprisingly refreshing and eye-opening exercises. Pardon the barking dog in the background. It's a neighbor's dog. It's a hot evening here in my upstairs office, and sound really carries. Now, Derek goes on to say, One last note. I prefer jazz as the music throughout Shrink Wrap Radio. It suits the topic and is a less commonly used genre in podcasts, so helps distinguish the show. Derek, thanks for taking the survey and for all this good info about the Princeton podcast series, but I'm curious about your comment about the music. Now, I lean towards jazz for the theme music as well, but I'm not sure if you're praising the current theme music, which I've used for maybe the last 10 to 15 shows, or the earlier piano clarinet jazz I use for the first 50 or so shows, maybe the first 75, I'm not sure. So please clarify that. The other sorts of sounds I've been considering is some kind of world fusion, mixing perhaps jazz or rock with sitar and tabla, something that's a bit mysterious and more energetic. What do listeners think of that idea? Next, we hear from Stefan P. at Penn State, a graduate student who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I've been interested in archetypes ever since you described them in your early podcast shows. I was looking for some summer reading now that finals are almost over, and I wondered if you could recommend some books for a beginner interested in broadly learning about archetypes. Also, if you know of any recent books which tie ancient archetypes to modern stories / movies, so I can hang my hat on some of the older ideas. Thanks." Derek, good question. Here are some initial ideas for reading on archetypes. I may get some more ideas as time goes by, or maybe listeners will send in some suggestions. First of all, the concept of archetype really comes out of Jungian psychology, so the more you understand about Jung, the better, and the more you read about Jung, the better. My favorite introduction to Jung is Boundaries of the Soul by June Singer. Others would be two volumes by Robert Johnson, one called He and the other called She. They are slim and would make a quick read, and they focus on the archetypes of anima and animus. I haven't read it, but Awakening the Hero Within by Carol Pearson would probably be a good choice as well. There are two tarot books that give great insight into archetypes, even if you're not interested in tarot. I'm thinking of Jung and Tarot by Sally Nichols and Tarot and the Journey of the Hero, and that's by a German author whose name I don't recall. Now, you can find all these on Amazon, both new and used. So I'll wrap it up with just one more, this one from Beth in Erlangen, Germany, who writes, "Dear Dave, I wrote almost a year ago to tell you how inspirational your show was to me to go ahead and do my psychotherapy training. I started in February, hey, good for you, and I am completely fascinated. As part of my training, I'm taking part in regular group therapy sessions with other psychologists and MDs training to become therapists. These therapy sessions are, on the one hand, pretty emotionally exhausting. They last two complete days from early morning to evening. Wow, those are marathon sessions. But I'm learning about facets of my own personality and perspectives on life which go far beyond just the need to learn therapeutic techniques for my future profession." Well, that sounds like really good training, that sort of intensive immersion. The best therapists all say that they learned it from being in therapy. So that's really good. She goes on to say, "I've especially become very aware of the fact that all of us live in a world of our own creation. Our concepts about the world give us structure and security, but they also blind us." Ergo my tagline of "It's all in your mind." She goes on to say, "You did a show about the healing power of forgiveness, and you mentioned a technique of taking responsibility for an event or situation in which you had been hurt emotionally. By doing this, you're able to see the situation in a completely different way. You realize that, in fact, we have a myriad of behavior options open to us. I think giving people the realization that there are many options open to them is one of the most important jobs of a therapist." And I echo that, indeed. She goes on, "Dave, your shows are an important part of my weekly routine. I listen to them when I'm making my kids dinner, cleaning the house, or jogging. Some shows make such an impression on me that I actually go back and listen to them a second time. They speak both to my heart and to my professional need to learn about psychological topics. The show on the heroine's journey with Maureen Murdoch struck a particular chord with me. Her work reminds me of the book Women Who Run with Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, a book which was really pivotal in my personal development. She says, if you haven't read this book, you should put it on your very long list of books to read. And in fact, it is there and has been for some time. I think I'll take a shortcut and try to get an interview with her. She goes on to say, the professor who is running the institute where I'm doing my training is a thanatologist, someone who studies death and the care of the dying. As part of our training, we did a meditation in which we went through the process of dying. The topic of dying and near-death experience is something I know little about, but this meditation and our subsequent talks about it has sparked my interest in this topic. I thought this might make a good topic for shrink wrap. Good suggestion. Finally, she says, I just listened to the show on warriors, settlers, and nomads and heard at the end of the show that the next guest will be Philip Zimbardo. His textbook, Psychology in Life, was my first brush with the field of psychology. He's one of the biggest names in psychology, and I am really thrilled to be able to hear him converse with you on your show. And of course, by now, that's already happened, and I was equally thrilled. Finally, she says, as many have already stated, thanks for all your hard work and keep up the good work. All the best, Beth in Erlangen, Germany. Beth, thanks so much for that very reinforcing letter. As I've said so many times before, it's letters like that that keep me motivated and keep me going. So I think that better wrap it up for today. And let me just close with saying, please help to grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you've got a podcast or a blog or a MySpace or a LinkedIn page or Facebook, put in a link and a plug there. So thanks again to Dr. Patrick Cohen for the opportunity to interview him on Peak Performance. Now, our next show will be with Dr. Tobin Hart on children's spirituality. That's going to be a juicy one. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.